Welcome to the Journal of Democracy podcast. We're joined today by Kurt Vieland, who is Lozano Long Professor of Latin American Politics at the University of Texas, Austin. And we'll be speaking with him today about his piece, Latin America's Authoritarian Drift, The Threat from the Populist Left, which appears in the July 2013 issue of the Journal of Democracy. And this piece actually appears as a free download at journalofdemocracy.org. So if you'd like to read Professor Vieland's work, you can go to journalofdemocracy.org and download that. So welcome to the show, Professor Vieland.
Yes, thank you for having me on the show.
Now, this is a very deep piece that you've written for us, and there's a lot to get into. But let's kind of start at the beginning, and I'm just going to read a brief quote from the piece itself and then get your comments on it. Near the beginning, you write that, quote, the military dictators of the 1960s and 1970s were ogres with no legitimacy who depicted themselves as stopgaps, house cleaners putting politics in order so democracy could return, unquote. But all of this seemed to have changed with Hugo Chavez and his kind of regional imitators. How is this new the new brand of populism that you describe different from the quote that I just read?
Well, what you have is this. In my article argues that this new brand of populism is also moving a number of countries towards authoritarian rule. But it's a very different type of authoritarian rule from the military dictatorships of the 60s and 70s that that quote refers to. Those were brutally overthrowing democracy. They were governing with a lot of open direct repression, including torture and disappearances. The new form of authoritarian rule that, in my view, countries like Venezuela, Bolivia, Nicaragua, Ecuador have established or are establishing is a very different soft form of authoritarian rule, where you have a popularly elected president using the power and patronage resources of the government to establish political hegemony, put a lot of pressure on the opposition, squeeze public opinion, all these kinds of things, and thus turning the countries into authoritarian regimes, but not with any massive human rights violations, not by openly breaking the democratic process. Instead, the democratic process is perverted from the inside by presidents who were elected. And so it is a form of authoritarian rule that is, if you wish, soft, that uses formally legal means often to pursue, in fact, undemocratic ends. But it's a form of authoritarian rule that has a much more attractive face, which is one reason why it finds more support in public opinion. And that is a form of authoritarian rule that is therefore in some sense harder to identify and to combat because it isn't as openly, brutally dictatorial as the old military dictators were.
And that gets us into an interesting question with regard to using formally legal means. You discuss constituent assemblies, and of course someone hears constituent assemblies, it sounds all very nice and proper, but you discuss them as a tool in the kind of populist toolkit. How does that work?
What you have there is the following, that these popularly elected leaders use their popular support to essentially emphasize majoritarian features so that the current majority gets to do what they want to do. That is essentially undermining the liberal pluralist features of democracy, because liberal pluralist democracy tries to establish strict procedures such that political minorities are also protected, such that you protect criticism, pluralism, opposition. And what you have in these governments is that they use their majoritarian support in order to squeeze out the opposition, in order to put pressure on the opposition, in order to undermine the safeguards that you have for criticism, for opposition in a democracy. So you have essentially the current majority taking advantage of its political hegemony in order to freeze itself in place, undermine competitiveness, and in that sense establish a political hegemony. So essentially, kind of majoritarian populism wins out over liberal pluralism, and in that way weakens the competitiveness that is very important for democracy.
And you discuss the use of these constituent assemblies and formally legal means in general in Venezuela, but there seems to have been some diffusion with regard to other regimes using this kind of technique. Could you discuss that a little bit?
Yes, exactly. Because what you see is the following. You see that Hugo Chavez was very successful in using the Constituent Assembly of 1999 to essentially undermine and destroy the opposition and to put its own political hegemony in place. And that caught on as a recipe. So you saw Evo Morales in Bolivia doing the same thing, Rafael Correa in Ecuador doing the same thing, essentially pushing for constituent assemblies, getting strong support for these constituent assemblies, and then using them to beacon liberal safeguards, to beacon the checks and balances in the constitutional system, to freeze in their majority for good, and to establish that majority for good. And so you really see that the Chavez recipe for establishing political hegemony has caught on and has inspired other leaders to follow the same route to this political hegemony.
Yes, and another innovation that, or it seems to be kind of packaged with using formally legal means, is what you call, and I think what is known as, discriminatory legalism. And this is, you actually have a great quote for this in the piece, which is this maxim: "For my friends, everything; for my enemies, the law." So explain that a little bit, how discriminatory legalism is used.
Yes, what you see there is that you have presidents have certain formal legal powers, and the leaders, Chavez, Evo Morales, Rafael Correa, use their powers in a discriminatory way, such that they essentially use them against the opposition. So, for example, the tax authorities dig up alleged problems in the public accounts of opposition governors. They investigate these opposition politicians. So what you see is that a legal means is used in a politicized way in order to undermine the political opposition, to threaten them. So, for example, Evo Morales in Bolivia has, with this kind of discriminatory legalism, has driven out virtually all the opposition politicians from Bolivia. There used to be a number of opposition politicians at the national level in different regions of Bolivia, and Morales and his supporters have found, in quotation marks, have found problems with the different legal problems that these opposition politicians allegedly faced. And given that these governments have controlled the judiciary, given that they have undermined judicial independence, given that the government has therefore a lot of control over the adjudication of legal disputes, these opposition politicians know, if I stand trial in Bolivia, I'm going to be convicted. And so therefore, a whole number of people have left the country, have auto-exiled themselves. And so you essentially use, these governments have used this discriminatory legalism to undermine and push aside and marginalize the opposition. And so you have something that looks formally legal, that is politicized, that very seriously skews the competitive playing field in a democracy. The government that is currently in power uses its legal means to marginalize, to make life very, very difficult for the opposition. So then you don't have a real functioning democracy anymore.
And it sounds like discriminatory legalism has been nearly impossible for the international community to impact in any significant way. And in fact, some of the democracy defense arrangements have ended up playing into the hands of populists.
Yes, that's another point of my article, because what you see is this: since a number of these measures are formally legal, although they are used in a politicized, discriminatory way, the international community has a very hard time to respond to this. The international community, the OAS, Resolution 1080, and these mechanisms, they have come up with a defense against the open, kind of brutal interruption of democracy through a military coup. What the international community has not managed to do is to find ways of preventing elected governments from using their powers, from using their legal means in order to establish their political hegemony and undermine competitiveness. And so you see, therefore, a big asymmetry. What essentially the international democracy protection regime has done is that it has had the unintended consequence that it protects popularly elected presidents against overthrow through coups. But it doesn't protect, it doesn't help the opposition to these governments. It doesn't help them, it doesn't protect them from the attacks that these governments do with these formally legal means against the opposition. So essentially, the presidents are protected, But then the presidents have pretty free hand to use their power and turn it against the opposition. And the opposition doesn't have any effective means of recourse because it can't, you know, this is officially, it's legal. And therefore, the international community also doesn't want to get very directly involved.
Now, there's another interesting angle to this, which is this comparison of the current crop of populist leaders in Latin America with the right-wing populist leaders of yesteryear.
Mm-hmm.
And there seems to be something that's more pervasive about this current brand. Why is that?
Yes, what you see, the second part of the article makes a number of arguments to that effect, because what you see is this, there was a group of right-wing populists like Carlos Menem in Argentina and Alberto Fujimori in Peru, more recently Alvaro Uribe in Colombia. And these presidents also tried to win more political power. They also tried to weaken checks and balances. They had a similar kind of impulse as the current left-wing populists, essentially using majoritarian plebiscitarian support and put pressure on the liberal pluralist features of democracy. But they were less successful for a number of reasons. One reason is that these right-wing populists were usually elected in emergency and crisis situations, like Fujimori, hyperinflation, Sendero Luminoso, Menem, hyperinflation. As soon as these presidents resolved these crises, their popular support diminished. By contrast, the Hugo Chavez, Evo Morales, Rafael Correa, the current group of populists, they are elected based on more kind of structural long-standing problems like poverty, inequality. And on those kinds of issues, it's very hard to make immediate quick progress and resolve them. And so these presidents can always argue, you know, I'm making progress, but it's going to take more and more and more time. And so they can maintain their popular support in many ways. Also, these current left-wing populists, they have increased economic interventionism, and so they have essentially given the government more economic tools for pursuing its political ends. By contrast, the right-wing populists of the 1990s, they subscribed to economic liberalism, which meant that the government gave up tools for interfering in the economy. You know, they privatized public enterprises, they liberalized trade, and so the government was losing power. So these right-wing populists weakened themselves politically, whereas the left-wing populists strengthened themselves politically. And so you see a number of reasons why these left-wing populists have had more capacity to pursue their goals. The goals are fairly similar. All populists want to extend their influence, and all of them try to put pressure on liberalism and pluralism. But the left-wing populists have been more successful. They have had more capacity to pursue these ends to a much further extent, actually really undermining, strangling democracy. The right-wing populists, usually with the exception of Fujimori, didn't get away with that.
And is it fair to say that the mindfulness of the poor that some of the left populists have gives this a more attractive face than, say, the right-wing populists?
Yes, absolutely. Because what you see is this. I mean, you see domestically that a number of voters in Venezuela, in Bolivia, in Ecuador are genuinely committed to Hugo Chavez, to Evo Morales, to Rafael Correa. And also on the international level, you see a number of intellectual celebrities who support Hugo Chavez. The right-wing populists had a much harder time in that respect, you know, because once they had resolved hyperinflation, what else is there to do? They didn't have the same kind of attractiveness, which in some sense, or let me say the other way around, the fact that the left-wing populists have more appeal makes their way of undermining democracy more dangerous. There is less opposition to that. It leads to less allergical reaction from different types of people. They get away with it more.
Now, one thing that's not covered explicitly in your article, but seems to play into this, is the commodities boom, particularly
yes.
in a place like Venezuela, which experienced
yes.
a substantial amount of oil revenue. Is there a reckoning that's ever in store for countries that base a lot of the social spending on commodities? Is there a sense that eventually the well will run dry and that other policies will have to be enacted that could perhaps lessen their personalistic rule?
It's a very important point. Because what you see is the following. The reason why these right-wing populists subscribed to economic liberalism was that the 1990s were a time of scarcity. The left-wing populists, in some sense, have been lucky because their coming to power has coincided with this commodities boom. And that commodities boom has allowed them to diverge from economic liberalism without facing the discipline of the market. And with, you know, Hugo Chavez has managed to spend and spend and spend all the economic liberal calls for budget equilibrium, for economic responsibility, he managed to laugh off because he had billions of dollars coming to state coffers every year. Now, for years and years, people have predicted that this commodities boom would come to an end. If and when it does come to an end, I think these left-wing populist governments will face significant difficulties. But so far, the end hasn't been in sight, you know. And so, in many ways, what you can say is there has been the left-wing populists have benefited from a lot of luck, just from international conjunctures that allowed them to do things, you know, disrespect the strictures of economic liberalism, of economic responsibility, if you wish, has allowed them to do things that earlier generations of populists didn't have the benefit of. So,
of course. Now, one thing that seems to be curious for international observers is to see Argentina moving in this direction, because it seemed that Argentina had such a hard-won democracy, and now to see some of these same patterns emerging there seems surprising. Is that surprising to you at all, or has
in many ways not? Because yes, Argentina has every reason to preserve democracy given the terrible experiences of the last military dictatorship. But what you also see is that Argentina, due to the great domestic importance of the Peronist movement, has always had this temptation of populism very strong. So you have essentially had, I mean, populist leaders from Juan Perón to Carlos Menem to the present day. And given that the commodities boom has indirectly benefited Argentina very much as well, there's also the economic opportunity to do so. I mean, Argentina, after the tremendous crisis of 2001-2002, hasn't really had anything that you could call a political party system anymore. The non-Peronist half of the party system literally evaporated, and there's nothing there in terms of real organized political parties. And the Peronist party, in many ways, has become so hegemonic that it has divided and fragmented into different factions. And so all of that has allowed personalistic leadership once again to become very important in the form of Néstor Kirchner, now Cristina Fernández de Kirchner. And so in the absence of institutions, in the absence of political parties, in a situation where personalistic leadership is sort of the main axis that politics revolves around, I mean, this is essentially populism. And then you add in the benefits of the commodities boom. In many ways, it's not surprising at all that Argentina would go in that direction as well.
And another case that people are, of course, watching closely is that of Venezuela, and particularly the extremely narrow margin of victory that Maduro secured has people wondering how sturdy is Chavismo kind of in the absence of Chavez himself?
Yes, a very difficult situation there in a government that hangs on fairly precariously. And it will be very interesting to see whether Maduro can manage to hang on, or whether they are the internal divisions in the Chavez movement, serious economic problems that the country faces, the out-of-control crime problem, whether that will lead to more and more of an erosion of political support. On the other hand, you know, Maduro has some assets there. One is that the Venezuelan state has such a commanding position in the economy that many sectors are beholden to, or they can essentially be blackmailed into at least not opposing Maduro directly. The other thing is that the crime problem is in some sense, if you wish, also an opportunity when the Maduro government feels the need to become more authoritarian, more openly repressive. They can always invoke that crime problem that for many years Hugo Chavez didn't want to address, that is still extremely acute and that many Venezuelans clamor and ask the government to address. And so that's in some sense, if you wish, a political asset, because, you know, if Maduro needs to crack down, there is a if you wish, a good domestic reason for a crackdown. And then the other asset that in some sense he has is that the tensions with the United States have been very significant. And so that means on the one hand, he always can pull the nationalist card, like now again with the asylum offer to Snowden. You know, once again, we are poking the US in the eye. See how brave we are. On the other hand, it also means is that he can the US in some sense offer a deal. I won't poke you in the eye in the future if you don't support the domestic opposition, if you don't point your finger too much at all the violations of, you know, competitiveness, of pluralism, of freedom in Venezuela. So there are a number of irons in the fire that Maduro still has. So it's very hard to predict what will happen there. Partly because, you know, our knowledge of internal decision making is very limited. I mean, the leadership of this movement is very non-transparent. You know, good part of the decision making about the succession of Hugo Chavez was done not actually in Venezuela, but together with the Castro brothers in Cuba. We don't really know who is influencing what and, you know, what goes in there. And so it's very hard to predict. It's a very, very opaque situation.
That seemed to be a revelation for many, the extent of Cuba's influence in Venezuela. Has that been known for some time among watchers of the region? It seemed to
be... People kind of knew about it, but it wasn't quite as obvious and in your face. And so now it's really kind of out in the open and very obvious. And so, I mean, there's clearly some concern in Venezuela among the Bolivarian movement, you know, I would assume among the supporters of Maduro, that at some point or other, for example, the Venezuelan military that has been quite penetrated by Chavismo, but where you still have an institutional position that wants to assert Venezuela's sovereignty, that there would be increasing discontent among the military. And so that as a result of that, there might actually be, you know, either pressure on Maduro not to go so far in the direction or... I mean, even at some point or other, a military coup.
And now I just have one last question for you, and then I'll let you get back to your day. And that is on Ecuador. I think people were expecting Ecuador to, or the Correa regime to kind of hang on to this idea that Snowden could come there and, yes, and do, you know, essentially what Venezuela is doing, or at least for a longer time. And it was surprising to some that they seemed to retreat from that so quickly.
I think that was very clearly U.S. pressure on the Andean Trade Trade Act, because, I mean, Ecuador depends on that. Ecuador is using the dollar. It's linked to the U.S. economy, and that Andean Trade Preference Act is coming up for a decision in Congress. And so I think the United States let them know, you poke us in the eye, there will be consequences, not necessarily even from the government, but from the U.S. Congress. And so I think that accounts for the very quick retreat of Korea on that front.
We've been joined today by Professor Kurt Vieland, Lozano Long Professor of Latin American Politics at the University of Texas, Austin. And Professor Vieland was speaking, at least at the beginning, about his piece, Latin America's Authoritarian Drift, The Threat from the Populist Left. We really appreciate you being here, Professor Vieland. This has been an illuminating conversation. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you for the conversation. It's very interesting.